My honest response is that it's been an honor to have kept that association with public radio on a daily basis as long as I have. And I'm very serious about that. All of us who work in public broadcasting, both on the television and radio sides, you know, we do it because there's a certain thing that we believe that public radio, for instance, can deliver to its listeners that you're not going to find elsewhere. I was at NPR full-time for about 10 years. I headed a programming department there. This was way back in the 80s. And the idea behind having the funding credits was to make a firewall between the content of the programming and the names of the folks who were supporting it, the agencies, the commercial businesses, the foundations, and in some cases, individuals. Well, I remember when I left NPR, my full-time position, to come up to Connecticut, which is where I'm talking to you from now, where I live. I came up here to teach. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm going to miss that daily connection. And I was lucky enough to be able to continue it. And that's meant a tremendous amount to me. My adult son for years called the funding credits the Mr. Dad Show. And when I told him that NPR was rethinking how they were producing the funding credits, basically bringing it in-house, which is the plan, and it'll probably happen. Listeners will start to hear the change probably mid to late November, maybe early December. So all of the production will be in-house as opposed to me up in Connecticut and a producer in D.C. And it should simplify things. That's the thinking behind it. And when I told my adult son that the Mr. Dad Show was not going to be renewed this fall, he had a two-part response to it. The first part was, well, Dad, that's a real bummer. And the second part was, but man, what a great ride. I like the identification with the network, even though I'm, for most part, totally anonymous, except, oh, gee, for today on WCBE.
Indeed. How have people, whether it's colleagues or folks that you run into on occasion, describe your voice?
Well, iconic is a word that I hear occasionally. I have mixed feelings about that. That just sounds like something is in stone and unchangeable, that type of thing. But then when I relax a little bit, I realize, well, that's not bad. You know, it's an iconic voice. I've been doing the funding credits longer than anybody else from the beginning of funding credits. So I take that as a compliment. I hear different descriptions. Some of them are not positive. Some of them are negative. People that get tired of listening to me, and I puzzle at some of the negative ones. And I'm nasal. I never thought of that. The problem with listening to any of the descriptions, Mike, and even when they're joking, I become very self-conscious about it, and then it messes me up when I'm reading the scripts during the next recording session.
Not to get too inside radio, the network is great, but they like things pronounced a certain way and yes, delivered in a certain way. Was that a struggle in the early part? And did you, I guess, reach a point where they sort of left you alone?
Yeah. And in the beginning, we were just making it up as we were going along, how we wanted them read and how long they would be. In the very early days, we had different lengths for the funding credits at the end of the programs and newscasts. And they did evolve. One of the things that we had early discussions about, Wendy Blair has been the producer of the funding credits from the very beginning up until, well, the beginning of this month. One of the things that she would push me to do is to be very precise in some of the reading and some of the pronunciations, to the point where it puzzles some listeners. And they're not shy. Public radio listeners are not shy. Part of the reason is that sometimes this is the only identification for a corporation or a foundation or an individual that they're going to have on public radio at the national level. So let's make sure if somebody is copying down or trying to remember that 1-800 number, they get it exactly because we only say it once. Or now that everybody has an email address and a website, that it's precise in terms of the pronunciation so they will be able to type in the correct thing. So it forces a kind of artificial reading that's become, well, I guess the standard reading that Tavares does when he slips into the funding credit voice. But then some odd things will come up. Wendy has encouraged me to pronounce, for instance, the H in some words that we normally don't pronounce. Like, it's not where, it's where. It's not what, it's what. And I don't talk like that, but I'm encouraged to do that. So I get it maybe 60 or 70% of the time. All of these little odd things, they're not accidental. That's what I like to tell people. And then there are some things, the first time we come across them, they're amusing. All of the hoodie-footy stuff that shows up around the, around the holidays, I love those. And then another time we had, this funding credit hasn't been on for years, a bedding manufacturing company called Duck's Bed, D-U-X. And so the beginning of that funding credit, support for NPR, comes from ducks. And it has to make you smile, right?
Public interactions, I mean, do you find that somebody instantly recognizes your voice, or they sort of look at you kind of strange as you're speaking? I mean, what do you see more of when you're kind of out and about?
It's funny. Every once in a while, where I'm having a conversation with somebody I've just met at the university or at a conference, and they'll say, "Boy, you know, you look familiar," because they confuse the visual cues with the audio cues. Or I'll get, "You know, your voice is familiar," and then I'll look around to see if I'm going to embarrass myself or them, and I'll ask them if they're a public radio listener, and if they say yes, and enthusiastically say yes, I'll lean towards them and I'll do the line, Mike. You know, the line, support for NPR comes from NPR member, and it's astounding the reactions that I get. After all of these years, it still surprises me that people, A, will recognize the voice, and that they react positively to that.
Well, let's move on to this book. When did your love of writing begin to flourish?
I think when I look back, I realize that I've had some fiction writing all the way back to high school and earlier. I have some things hidden in my archives. But in terms of really seriously knocking down the fiction, I guess it was probably maybe 15 years ago. And I have several unpublished novels that I've worked on. And each time I've pursued that, my writing has become stronger. And then along the way, I started writing the short stories because they don't take as long to work on as the novels, and always have a couple of projects going at the same time. And then when they're published, it's very affirming. Somebody believes that your writing is actually, the expression I like to use, in English. It's making sense. Earlier this year, a friend who had been encouraging me for several years, pull these things together, put a collection together. And I finally said to him, "Okay, all right, fine, I will." It's so funny, Mike, because at the beginning I thought, how hard is this going to be? All of these things have been written, so that's the hardest part, right? And most of them have been published, so, you know, I'll just put them together, send them to the publisher, and, you know, go on and teach my classes and work on other stuff. Not so fast, Tavares. It's been a real learning experience. Everything from choosing which ones are going to be in the collection to which ones, Mike, also not in the collection. The order of the stories, the character names and how they show up in different stories, the title of the book, the cover design. And I have to give the I have to give the publishing company and the publisher and the editor much credit for making sure that, well, it's like recording the NPR credits. All of the stuff is going on in the background, and they just tell me what I need to know so I'm not, totally crazy.